of the interview with Harry Wexler. The interviewers are Judy Rubenstein and Lois Weaver. Oh, that's all right. You can call me whatever you like. I have lots of names. Okay.
Okay, you were telling us about...
I think that what this shows is how difficult times were financially. And I guess as we look back upon it now, it's hard to feel how we suffered. But I think that we did. And
that you did suffer?
Well, I think, from financially, the depression. Mm-hmm. We were, affluence was a rare thing. We were all happy that we were able to live in a warm house with good food and wear good clothes that were, I wouldn't say slightly stylish, but at least that which we didn't have to be ashamed of. And just to meet that was a chore for any wage earner in the family. And my own job, which I had in 1939 and 40, I made 25 cents an hour. And
what did you do?
I was an usher at the theater. And one year they made me chief usher, and I went from 25 cents to 30 cents an hour. So that was quite a climb. I'll tell a story that I dated a girl who came in to town and took her to what was a popular place for us in those days, to the Chatterbox. And I got $3 a week. I was working part-time then. That was during the school years. I was working 12 hours a week. And they took a quarter out because a quarter went into the Warner Club. So that I was with the Warner Brothers Theater.
What was the Warner Club?
I guess it was for... sick benefits and a home for the aged, and, for people who retired who needed help, things of that sort. And so I had $2.75, and I took this girl to the Chatterbox on a Saturday night and paid for parking, and we went dancing, and including my tip and everything, didn't cost me $2.75. So just think about it's almost unbelievable.
What else did you do for fun and recreation?
Well, the temple offered a lot of that to us, and I was a member of the AZA, and I think the reason I joined the AZA in those days was so you could play basketball, and go to dances, and then you got interested in other things that were there. For example, they had a debate team, they had public speaking, they had a religious program, and it was a very big part of our lives. Sometimes on a Saturday night, I might go up to the temple, to the old social hall, house, I guess it was, and meet some friends and we just congregated there. And we may not have done anything. We did have a pool table, and we did shoot some pool. We had a terrible gym that we called a basketball floor that I think was not much over 8 feet high, but we all played ball there, and we enjoyed it.
Where was this located?
This was at the on Shaw Avenue, at the corner of Lincoln and Shaw Avenue, where the temple is today. But the social hall was in back of the social house was in back of the temple. That's where we had Sunday school, and I just learned from some people in town that house was formerly on the corner of Lincoln and Shaw, and was moved back when they built the temple. I don't know if you know that or not. And downstairs, which is now the A.M. Simon Hall, was then my basketball floor.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, and we all enjoyed that. We had fun.
Who were your friends as you were growing up?
Well, one of my best friends is right here. So. I guess that Lois and I know each other since we've been able to talk, or we can remember. Is that right? And unfortunately,
Lois Moskowitz.
Yeah, right. And thing that's been wonderful is that we've kept some of these friends. Herb Siegel was one of them. Alan Amford, Vivian Abrams, who's now Vivian Harris, in town. Connie Friedman, Connie Rothman. And I forgot about Connie. We should say on Friday night how we went up to Connie's after Temple or something like that, and all the boys and girls congregated there. It was on Beach Street, so we called it Connie's on the Beach. So and the whole social sphere of what involved this. I mean, this was it. As I can look back on it, these friendships have been everlasting, and we've all had good times and we've had some bad times. But regardless, we've enjoyed it together.
Most of your friends Jewish?
It so happens that I would say in those early years, I think that we have to say yes, most of our friends were Jewish. That was the social thing, I think. We did have non-Jewish or Gentile friends, but that was almost a secondary thing.
Didn't date them?
No, rarely did we date them. And we may have gone out together a lot, but we certainly didn't date one another.
Could you contrast life growing up and living in McKeesport with some of your friends who grew up in Pittsburgh?
Well, I think there's nothing like growing up and living in a small town. And the interesting thing is, my wife said I had to mention her name. Helene comes from New York.
Best friend?
Yeah, well, my best friend, Helene Dreyfus. And we moved here 1954, so we've been here almost 30 years, and lived in McKeesport. Helene lived on the west side of New York and lived in an apartment all her life. Since that time, we've lived in a house, two homes that we've had, and she refuses to move from the area. And so it tells the impact of a small town. I think there's something great about a small town in that people have a real feeling for one another, a desire to help, and you don't get that anywhere else. And there's no problem that people will, whatever the time or whatever the occasion, they will they're available to help you when you need them.
Since we have to mention Helene again,
yeah.
Would you like to tell us about your courtship?
Well, that's interesting because I went to my college days were spent at Duke University, both my undergraduate and my graduate. I went to medical school at Duke, so I was almost a Southerner, I guess. I lived there went to school in 1941 and graduated in 1947. Since it was during the war, I literally went to calendar years and not academic years or school years because we went summer and regular season. When I left Duke in 1947, I came back here and interned a year at the West Penn Hospital in Pittsburgh. I'm not trying to avoid talking about Helene, but I'm building up to her. spent a year here in Pittsburgh, and then I went to New York. And I was at the the City Hospital, which was on...
A resident,
yes, in dermatology, which was on Welfare Island, which is in the middle of the East River, which is now a very fine place to live.
Roosevelt Island,
right. In those days, it was... And the City Hospital, some parts of it, I think, were first built in the Civil War, which is interesting. The service there was a Columbia University service that I was on, so from there I was asked if I would go up to Columbia, and I finished and really did the major part of my training in dermatology at Columbia Presbyterian. I was introduced to Helene as a blind date and actually calling her on the phone to make the date by a friend of mine who was a resident at City Hospital. And we first met, I guess, November the 10th of 1949. I remember that. And that was a very short courtship. I think that the only reason we didn't get married sooner is because our parents thought it wouldn't look good if we got married that quick. So we waited until May the 4th and
1950,
and we were married, but there was no question about that. Elaine was working at the time and actually continued to work when I was, after we were married. The residents in those days didn't make the money that residents are making today. At best, maybe a couple $100 a month and sometimes less than that. So we lived with Elaine's folks after we were married in May of 50. And as luck or whatever it would be had it, I was the Korean conflict broke out in latter 1950, and I was still in the reserve, and I was called up to duty. So not only was did they call me up, but they shipped me to the Far East.
When was that?
That was in December of 1950. So I think I arrived in Japan something like December the 8th or something like that, 1950.
Right, after you were married.
Yeah, and we were married just in May, so that was kind of a devastating blow. And fortunately, I didn't remain there too long. I was in the Navy, but on loan to the Army. So after 6 or 7 months, they brought me back in June of 51. And since that time, I think we've spent all the time together. I finished out my tour in the Navy. We stayed in, Wayne spent a year and a half with me, actually, when I came back in July of 51, and then I was mustered out of the Navy, I guess, in 52. Finished my training in New York, where I had hoped to remain as a member of the faculty at the school, and was.
At Columbia,
right. Mm-hmm. And my uncle...
1951.
That was 1954, actually. I went back there in 52, and I finished up...
You lived in New York then?
I lived in New York from 52 to 54. And in March of 1954, the uncle who I spoke of, who was the dermatologist, died suddenly. And I was faced with the problem of either trying to make an honest living in New York or coming back and making a living here. I approached my professor at Columbia, and I was making $5,000 a year at the time, and I asked him if he could give me $7,500, because if he could give me $7,500...
And you were on the faculty at
Columbia? I was a member of the faculty, right.
And
And he said to me, I said, if you can give me $7,500, I can stay, but I can't stay for $5,000. And by this time, we had already had two children. And he said, well, how could he give me $7,500? That was impossible. So the rest is history. I left and came back here and took over my uncle's practice.
And the year was?
1954. So for the past 28 years, this has been home again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I have, you think what might have been. I don't think I have any regrets upon what I did. And I was able to enjoy the better of two worlds because of some people who were very nice to me. And I was able to carry on a clinical practice, and then actually had some academic atmosphere that I moved about in.
Would you like to explain that a little more?
Well, I was always interested in investigative work in medicine, and actually the person who I spent a lot of time with is Dr. Edwin Fisher, who is a pathologist now at Shadyside Hospital, who then was at the University of Pittsburgh at the VA Hospital, and Ed permitted me to come into his laboratory and to work there. And not only did he give me the opportunity to work in it, he taught me techniques which I really have never had any experience with, and I was able to really enjoy another part of professional life that that I didn't have. I think that investigative work is an exciting thing. However, I think that there's nothing like clinical work or taking care of patients. That's usually the most satisfying and rewarding. From that, I was able to kind of carry on what I had hoped I could do at Columbia. And over the years, I've been able to participate in this kind of an academic environment and also enjoy clinical practice and private practice and medicine.
Nice combination.
Yeah.
We didn't ask in the early years about the health and medical care.
Well, I think that that's another thing.
Uh-huh.
We talked about the gap in the generation of living today and living for the young people and when we were young. I graduated medical school in 47, and there's a complete metamorphosis that's taken place in medicine. I mean, it's almost like another era, another chapter. In my lifetime, I've seen penicillin and the use of antibiotics, which were not available when we were children, certainly almost stamping out infectious and contagious disease as we knew it. The use of drugs, miracle drugs like cortisone, prednisone, treating diseases that were absolutely futile and fatal. In dermatology, we treat a condition called lupus erythematosus, which is a very severe disease in many instances. And I can recall when I was a resident at City Hospital, I had a patient who was black and 21 years old. And the mother came to me and said she wanted to do anything that she could to save her daughter. And at that time is when oreomycin first came out. I don't know if you remember this antibiotic, but it was probably the next antibiotic after penicillin. And she said, at that time, it was selling for $1 a capsule, which, and think of that in what that would be today. I mean, that would be like $10 a capsule. And she says, I can go out and I can buy $21 worth of this if you'll give it to my daughter. So I said to her, you know, we don't waste your money. Unfortunately, we can't do anything for your daughter, and what you're going to do isn't going to help her at all. But today, these patients are alive because we can give them drugs that they survive. And just the miracles in the surgery, doing open heart surgery, things of that sort, bypass operations for aneurysms. When I was a resident in New York, Albert Einstein was a patient at Jewish Hospital in Brooklyn. And some of my friends were taking care of him. And just a little aside from what I'm talking, they said that no matter when they went in to see him, he was always sitting up in bed working with his little notebook and writing out equations. And they had one of them was had a master's degree in genetics. Mm-hmm. So they decided that they were going to send this resident in to draw his blood and to see if they couldn't stump him on genetic questions. Well, when they started genetics, he actually demolished them. He knew so much about it that they didn't know what they were talking about. But the thing why I bring in Einstein is because Einstein had an aneurysm of the aorta. And they opened him up and they saw this and they realized there was nothing they could do. And they told him he had gallbladder disease and I think he lived for a few years following up. But today we would replace that.
How old was he then?
He was in his 70s, I think. I don't remember how old he died.
That's still very dying.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and so you think about all this, and you think that, but I know if my uncle came back today, he wouldn't understand what's going on with the patients, you know, and the medication that's available, and the high technology,
mm-hmm.
like CAT scans and things of that sort. So it's a whole new revelation. And I'm certain that a generation from now, they'll be saying, well, how did you people treat cancer? How could you have treated it so badly like that? You know? And we'll see breakthroughs there. So this is so exciting from a participant's point of view and from being a bystander, you know, just to see this and to be part of it. So medicine has done that. And of course now we're dealing with an aging population and that's where new thrusts will have to be made.
The Dr. Fisher that you mentioned, the pathologist,
yeah.
isn't that the one that has made a lot of significant inroads in cancer research?
Well, I think that Edwin is a national standing and a great researcher. He and his brother have been working, Bernie Fisher himself, have been working on breast cancer, and Ed has contributed so much as far as pathology is concerned in the study of cancer. So.
Can we jump back now into a little bit of your family life?
Yeah.
Would you tell us about your children when they were born and so forth?
Well, my children are not children. I have two, or rather, Helena and myself have three children, and two girls, the oldest being Lynn and the youngest being Mara, and Dick is our middle one.
They were born when?
Lynn will be 30 years old, so she was born in 1952, when we were stationed in Newport, Rhode Island, in the Navy. And there was no Planned Parenthood then, but we had our own, and a year later our son was born, and by that time we had gone back to New York, and Dick was born at the Harkness Pavilion at Columbia Presbyterian, and Laura was born here at the Keysport Hospital, I think about 1956. I just can't remember her exact age. Although she's 25, I think she's going to be 26. First of all, we're both very proud of them. They've developed very well, and Lynn has a master's in occupational therapy and is directress of the program here at the VA Hospital in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
Married to a fine fellow by the name of Glenn Kramer, who is a financial analysis for Rockwell International. Laura is married to one of the Broffs from Pittsburgh here, Charlie Broff, who is a graduate in architect and now at Pitt doing an MBA. Laura graduated University of Pittsburgh in a Bachelor of Arts degree. She's working at the Union National Bank downtown. I should say that Lynn graduated Washington University and did her graduate work at Columbia, where her husband also did. And Richard and Dick, as we all know, more Dickie probably is more correct, went to the Connecticut College for the graduate Connecticut College with a degree in art history, which was also large for Laura's major. And Dick pursued it as a profession. He was 3 years with the Museum of African Art in Washington, and now is with the National Public Radio as their publicist for their new show, All Things Considered. And he is now also into jazz and has been the publicist for their jazz program and actually has produced a show of his own, which will be aired this February.
Jazz show?
A jazz show, yes. And they're all industrious and productive. And self-productive. And fortunately, we're able to enjoy the two girls because they're here, and mm-hmm. their husband, and Dick isn't that far away that we can, he can come up from Washington, or we can go down there, so. They've done well.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the time in between as they were growing up?
Well, I think that, Helene says that I was the physician, so that the children would awake at night, that I was to get up with them because she would only have to wake me anyhow. So I kind of had a nightlife with them. I enjoyed them. I think that they kept us young. And I think anyone who doesn't have children around can miss that. You grow old too fast. In fact, we miss them around the dinner table now. They had all the activities, I guess, and all the bruises and whatever happens to children as they grow up. They did rather well. I think that they have good values. I would like to think that we were influential, and even if we weren't, I would like to think that we were. I think that they understand what it is to have responsibility, and which is probably the most important thing. They were responsible people. I would not worry about them taking care of themselves.
What kind of things did you do together? Family vacations?
Yes, they went on many times. They made mm-hmm. trips with us. And I guess one of their trips was very influential on me because I took them down to Charlottesville to see Monticello and then on to Williamsburg to see the place there. This was in 1963, and that had a great influence on me. I became a Jeffersonian after that, and actually have pursued that as an avocation. So I think that that's probably what they did for me. I made that trip. But we made many trips together. We went to New York together. We made a trip across the country where we spent 6 weeks traveling across Canada and coming back over New York.
Would you like to explain to us a little bit more about your Jeffersonian interest? Is there another plug here that we can try?
Yeah, but I know that plug. Shoot.
I have a machine.
It's going.
Okay. We're all right?
This is session 2 on February 4th, 1982. Lois Weaver and Judy Rubenstein interviewing Dr. Harry Wexler. Harry, at the end of our last session, you just mentioned that you took a family trip to Williamsburg, and that's when you began a new interest.
Right. We visited Monticello when we were in Charlottesville, and I must say that I never was impressed with anything so much, and I was just amazed that an 18th century home could have been lived in today and had so many of the 20th century conveniences. So I wanted to find out about this fellow Thomas Jefferson, and I went down to the little bookstore there and bought my first biography on him, which was done by his great-great-granddaughter Sarah Randolph. And read that, and then from there, just kind of everything proliferated. I started to read books on him and about him and by him, and really through that gained an interest in some of the things that he was interested in, philosophical ones, political ones, and started to read people who were his friends and kind of spread out from there.
Before or after you became a veteran?
This is before, because what I first did was I wanted to own a document by Jefferson, which I did buy. And then as I tried to collect these, they became much too costly, so I turned to books and started to buy earlier editions. Really, with no interest in sight other than just having this material on Jefferson. It was then that I a friend of mine made arrangements for me to visit the Hunt Botanical Library in Pittsburgh because I had a book I wanted to have rebound. Mm-hmm. And the binder there was someone that I had made arrangements to see. Well, as it turned out, the bindery at the Hunt didn't have enough time to bind their own books. And I did meet the director of the Hunt, who was George Lawrence. He invited us to become members of the Bibliophiles. And so...